So we are still in Ecclesiastes, which I believe begins around page 553 of the black Bibles that are provided for you. Last week we started looking at Ecclesiastes 2, and we only got through the first point of the three-point sermon. So we looked at self-indulgence as a means of giving you a sense of happiness, a sense of contentment, a sense of life is good. Ecclesiastes is written by Solomon. He's called the preacher throughout the book. And we saw last week that he left no stone unturned as he looked at self-indulgence, as he looked at satisfying just his own pleasures, his own physical desires, whether it was for riches and fortune or toys and trinkets or a good reputation or influence or affluence or sexual desires or escape through wine or escape through music or just anything. He turned to everything. He had the means to look at all of this, and in the end it was all vaporous. It was all fleeting. It was all empty. There was no point to it all. And we started out last week by considering that all of the things that Solomon looks to throughout the book of Ecclesiastes, most of them are good things that have been twisted because he's taken these good things and said, is this what ultimately life is all about? And it's all about then the idols, as the women are studying or reading together, the idols of the heart. John Calvin says that the heart is an idol factory. We make these little gods. We take the good resources from God, but then we turn them into ultimate things. We take good things and we make them into God things. And as I said last week and said back when we were looking at Genesis years ago, when you take a good thing and make it into a God thing, you've done a bad thing and it ruins everything. When you take a good thing and you make it a God thing, you say, this is what will satisfy. This is what gives my life meaning. You could make, draw out a little sentence on the bottom of your outline or somewhere on the notes somewhere. You could write out, if I have blank, I will be satisfied. If I have blank, I will be satisfied. If I accomplish blank, if I do blank, if this is in my life, I will be satisfied. I will know I'm okay. And that blank becomes this little pyramid that you try to balance your life on. And so you could draw that above that sentence, a little pyramid, and then draw a teeter-totter or a seesaw, depending on where you grew up and what you rode on. But the draw a fulcrum? Balance? Thank you. Whew. All right, so draw a fulcrum and put one end down at the bottom, put a negative sign, and one end up at the top and put a positive sign, because this is what we do with our idols. We look at our lives and we put them on this fulcrum and we say, if I have blank, I will be satisfied. And so when I don't have it, when my life is missing that item, I feel insecure. I feel depressed. I feel ashamed. I feel like I have to hide from people. I have to lie about who I am because I'm missing this. And if I had it, my life would be full and I'd have meaning. And so, but then I go up to the top and you think, well, what you need is just be good at it. But up at the top, if I have those things, now I'm self-righteous. Now I'm certain that if you had this in your life, you would be as happy and pleased as me. I'm confident, and I am pretty certain that God exists to keep this in place. Interestingly, when I'm down at the bottom end, I'm pretty sure God exists to get this in place. So at the bottom end, I'm angry at God because I don't have it, and He's supposed to give it to me, especially when it's a good thing that I've turned into this God thing. You know, a happy family, a nice relationship, a decent job, all these things that are written about in the Bible. They're all through the Proverbs. If you do good stuff happens to you. I'm doing good stuff isn't happening to me. God lied. And so, but then up at the top, I've got it all. And God's just sort of off on the corner. And it's like, as long as you don't mess with this, God, you and I will be fine. Just don't touch this. And so we take these good things and turn them into God things. We turn them into ultimate things. And in Ecclesiastes 2, the first ultimate things that Solomon explores are the ultimate things of just personal pleasure. Build houses. Build gardens. Build things, collect things, get treasures, get people to have slaves of slaves, have women, have wives, have concubines, have wine, have song. Just fill your life with distractions and you'll be satisfied. And he says, it's a lie. It's all meaningless. It's all empty. But our hearts are resourceful, aren't they, as far as idol factories? You know, we don't shut down just because one idol isn't producing. We just go to new resources. We say, well, if I'm not supposed to find satisfaction in pleasure, because as good Christians, we know that Christianity is really all about making sure that you don't do anything that you enjoy. God never said that, but we as Christians assume that, and so we think, well, what God really wants is for me to be better. I'll improve myself. I'll just get better. I'll make myself better. Or we go even one step further and say, well, in this culture, I'm a good Christian if I have a good job. So what's my job? What do I do? What I do defines who I am. And we recognize that culturally. We even balk at it because when you meet someone new, within the first 45 seconds of meeting a new person, especially between men, and I only say especially between men because I've never been a woman, so I don't know if this happens with you all in those first 45 seconds, but within the first 45 seconds of meeting someone, what is the first question you ask? What do you do? Because we act as though what you do will tell me all I need to know about who you are. Now, part of it is because, you know, in 45 seconds of meeting someone, you don't want to say, so what are your deepest struggles in life? So we recognize that you need entry point questions. So I'm not saying, like, it's awful, but it is awful if we stop at what you do. Because we even asking what you do opens opportunities. Are you enjoying it? Is it easy? Is it hard? Are there struggles in what you do? Because the preacher says, if you're honest, what you do is most of the time an awful thing. So let's stand for the reading of God's word. Ecclesiastes 2, verses. We'll begin in verse 12. So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I perceived that the same event happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity. For of the wise, as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come all will have been long forgotten, how the wise dies just like the fool. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me. For all is vanity and a striving after wind. I hated all my toil, in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me, and who knows whether he will be wise or a fool, yet he will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun. Because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. The grass withers and the flowers fade, and yet the word of the Lord remains forever. Please be seated. So in 1985, Neil Postman wrote a book called Amusing Ourselves to Death. Has anyone read Neil Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death? Very well-written explanation, I'd say, of where culture had gone in 1985. It was interesting that he died before Donald Trump was elected, but when Donald Trump was elected, his son's Twitter feed and email box was bombarded by folks who had read his father's work, just asking, what would your father say now? Because his whole argument was that it was 1985 when his book came out, so he was writing it, you know, in the early 80s, and back then it was really cool to look at George Orwell's book, 1984, because it was almost 1984, and assume, hey, this is where we're going. Government is coming in. Big Brother is watching. They're going to steal all your freedoms and rights. And Postman's argument was that we are not, although that would be convenient to blame it all on the government, that's not the novel that seems to be defining where our culture has gone. And he argued that the novel that defines us more accurately was Huxley's Brave New World, where big government didn't come in and steal our rights and freedoms, but we willingly and gladly gave them up and sold our rights and freedoms for a drug that would make us just feel euphoric and happy and satisfied all our days. And so we didn't really care about our freedoms and rights as long as we could have this drug that made us feel satisfied. Postman described culture in this way, and this I thought was interesting. He says, we, and this is 1985, admittedly, so many of you are like, that's like, didn't World War II end in 1985? It didn't, so I just bear with me for a moment of culturally irrelevant illustration. But his point, three things that he's used to describe our culture, he said, we worship our work, we work at our play, and we play at our worship. We worship our work, we work at our play, we play at our worship. Last week, we looked at this idea of working at play, and you can see that still today. I mean, our play, the efforts that we put into vacation, the things that we fill our vacations with. We get home from vacation, and how many of you men, you get home from vacation and you're so glad to get back to the office? It was exhausting. You're just up and out and running and doing, and you get back and you're like, oh, I gotta sit down for a little while. It'd be nice to sit for 4 hours, get up and have lunch, and then sit for four more hours. And that's nice. It's a good break from vacation. We work desperately at our play. Now, in 1985, workaholism was still a thing, not so much anymore, and so we used to worship our work. We used to think, this is it. I define myself by what I do, and you must know how good I am at what I do. And now, today, as I looked at it, I thought, we probably more worship and work at our play. We still play at our worship, and we despise our work. So work is just a necessary evil so that I can go play more. So we work in order to be able to work at our play. And so that's where work has fallen. But we still play at our worship, and that will come out later in Ecclesiastes. But the preacher sees that self-indulgence was not the answer. So he turns to self-improvement. So maybe not escape. Maybe I just need to be a better me. Be all I can be. Now, he's already mentioned wisdom in chapter 1, but he just returns to it briefly. And he says, now, obviously, on the surface, wisdom is better than folly. I mean, if we're going to compare wisdom, being smart and being dumb, being smart is better. So don't misunderstand the preacher when he says that, you know, it doesn't matter at all. He says, now, there's certainly value in wisdom. Wisdom's better than folly, just like light is better than dark. A wise person has his head in his eyes in his head. A fool just walks around in darkness. But what is the purpose? What am I looking for from self-improvement? What is it that I'm after? And if it's anything beyond just, well, anything, it's useless. It's worthless. It's pointless. It's vaporous. It's not lasting. Why do I improve myself? Well, why do I fill my head with some of this trivial knowledge and information I have? Well, because I like to be the guy that knows these things. But there's always some guy that knows more of these things than I know. And so then it becomes fleeting. And he says it's more than just fleeting, though. No matter how smart you are, you can't outsmart death. Now, you might live your life in a wise way that sort of delays the inevitable if you live your life with health concerns and what you eat and how you exercise, and you do this in a wise, discerning way, then yeah, you can prolong this hard life, but you can't put off death inevitably. He says, so what is the point of self-improvement? I mean, my life ends just like the fool's life. Leonard Wolfe, I know he sounds brilliant. Leonard Wolfe was the publisher. He was a political theorist, co-founder of the Bloomsbury Group. He was the husband of Virginia Wolfe, the novelist. He spent his whole life pursuing self-improvement and seeking to help others find self-improving activities. He supported the arts and publishing and made sure that works were out there for making society better. And this is how he summarizes his own life. He says, I see clearly that I have achieved practically nothing. The world today and the history of the human anthill during the past 5 to 7 years would be exactly the same as it is if I had played ping pong instead of sitting on committees and writing books and memoranda. I have therefore to make a rather ignominious confession that I must have in a long life ground through between 150,000 and 200,000 hours of perfectly useless work. He looks back at his life and looks at society and culture and says, if I had never existed, this is where society would be today. What was all of this for? People who work on PhDs, no matter what field, I mean, even in the seminary field, even in theological field, they work on PhDs, 10 years, 12 years of their life poured into working on this dissertation, this tome of intelligence and information. And what is it that they're after? What is the sign as a PhD that you have arrived? Do you want to know what it is? When you are referenced in the next guy's PhD work. So that is a sign of arrival when this guy's work looks at your work and says, his work was really good. So your 10 to 12 years of labor was for a footnote. That's how you know your work was worth something, if you become a footnote at the bottom of someone else's 10 to 12 years of work. Who, by the way, his goal is to become a footnote at the bottom of the next guy's work, so you will be 2 degrees removed from being referenced. That's the goal of PhD work, so that someone will reference my work one day in his work. It feels so utterly meaningless. No wonder the preacher looks at it all and he says, I hated life. He didn't just hate life, he hated his work. I hated all the toil with which I toiled under the sun. He hated his labor. And there were two reasons that he gives for hating his labor. One is, first of all, you can't take it with you, and whoever gets it after you won't appreciate it. So that's the first reason he hates his work. You can't take it with you. All of your labors, all of your efforts, even your, you know, even your hobbies, your collections. So in 1992, Amy and I were married. A few months after we're married, Amy's mom comes to visit, and she has Amy's stuff. How many of you, you got married, you thought you were just getting a spouse? No, you were getting your spouse's stuff. And so she came with these boxes. And among these boxes were like two or three well-packed, sealed, fragile boxes. And on them it said, bells. Bells. So Amy used to collect bells. So these boxes came. We were newlyweds, so you know, I mean, it's wonderful. I'm so glad to have her bells. We even opened it. We unwrapped a bell. It's a bell. Diggy, 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 ding. There's lots of them in there. We looked at one, very fragile, rewrapped it carefully, retaped the box. We had a little storage unit that came with our apartment. So those boxes went into that storage unit in 1992. So in 1994, we moved from Baltimore to Raleigh, North Carolina, from one apartment to another apartment. As we were packing up our apartment in Baltimore, we were pulling things out. We opened the storage unit, pulled out these boxes. Here are these bells. I said to Amy, I said, can we get rid of these? No. What? No. What kind of question is that? Apparently I had been married too long to realize I shouldn't ask that kind of question yet. So we moved the bells. The bells came with us. They stayed packed, stayed taped, didn't open them. They went from one storage unit to a storage unit in our apartment in Raleigh. In 1997, we were still in that apartment in Raleigh. There were three of us instead of two of us, and there were about to be four of us instead of three of us. And so we were getting ready to move into our first home, a house in Raleigh, a little 1,200 square foot, wonderful home, was 12,000, anyway, beautiful little house, now more storage, an attic. We started packing up, pulling things out, got to the storage unit, pulled out the boxes. I asked Amy, can we get rid of these bells? What? No. No, we can't get rid of these bells. I collected these bells as a child. I mean, I said, okay. I mean, we got an attic now. I mean, we can have as many boxes of bells. We could restart the collection if you want. But we didn't. And we didn't open them. And they stayed taped. They stayed well packaged. And they went from the storage in the apartment to a storage in an attic in our house in Raleigh. And then in 2001, we were then six instead of four. And our house, our 1,200 square foot house, was not big enough for six. But the house down the road was big enough for six. It was a bigger house, bigger bedrooms, bigger storage, two attics. And we got to that house, no garage yet. I don't know, Raleigh has a thing against garages, I haven't figured that out. But packed up the little house, got ready to move to the big house, pulled out the boxes from the attic. I said to Amy, what do you think I said to her? Can we get rid of these? What did Amy say? What? No. What? No. These are my bells. The bells, the bells. So the bells moved in 2001 from a small house to a big house. And we had the bells, still unopened. In fact, I don't even know if these four here are aware until this illustration these bells existed. That's how important these bells are. Our offspring aren't even aware of them. You can see what's happening to me. So 2007, we are packing up the house. We are getting ready to move up the coast to Stafford, Virginia. It is a new life. It is a new day. It's time to start fresh. We're not going to add any more kids. In fact, maybe this is a good time to start getting rid of things. And so we start unpacking and or unloading the attic, and the stuff comes out. The bells get out onto the floor, and I just stand there and I look at them. And I looked up at Amy, and I didn't say anything. Amy looked at the bells, and she looked up at me, and she said, "We should probably just get rid of those." Do you know what I said? I said, "Are you kidding me?" I said, "These bells have been unpacked once in our marriage, and they've lived in a tiny apartment in Baltimore, and they've lived in a tiny apartment in Raleigh, and they've lived in a tiny house in Raleigh, and in a bigger house in Raleigh." I said, "I am never getting rid of these bells." And so those bells are in our attic, still unopened, still untaped. Don't you feel like some of the things you pour your life into are sort of on that level of, what was that all about? What was the point of all that? I mean, that was a hobby, obviously. It wasn't a job, but you know, the things that we collect, even through our jobs or whatever, I mean, your kids aren't going to care about it. They're going to, at best, sell it. At best. And at worst, it just ends up in the Stafford landfill or donated somewhere. And maybe that's better than selling it, because how many of us know just horror stories of children of deceased parents just having decades-long feuds because of they couldn't decide what to do with all the stuff or the inheritance or how to divide it just so perfectly evenly, and it breaks up families. I mean, that's the ridiculous stuff. But then there's the important stuff, stuff that you thought, this is really important. This is like life-defining stuff. And there's no saying, the preacher says, there's no telling if the one after you is going to care at all or even be wise with it. You know, Solomon, what was his job? Solomon was the king of Israel. He was the king of Israel for about 40 years. That's about the span of a normal career, isn't it? So for 40 years, his job was king of Israel. He did his job well. He was considered the wisest king of Israel. Other kings and queens came from miles to see him do his job well. He could put on seminars, you know, how to be a good king in the whatever century BC, although that would be weird because, like, nobody knew it was BC at the time, so then you'd know that was fake. But anyway, he built houses, he built walls and gardens, he organized Israel into 12 districts, he built cities to store the economic prosperity that he had led Israel through. He built the temple. He built Solomon's castle. And what did his successor do? So he does all of this. He builds it all. It's an amazing, I mean, it's a world power, Israel at the time. And his very successor, his son, in one foolish decision, loses more than 80% of the kingdom like that. His son loses more than 80% of the kingdom because of a foolish decision. One thing that's wrong with work, you can't take it with you, and you have no guarantee that anyone after you is going to care. But there's more that's wrong with our labor, isn't it? And we touched on it earlier. Another thing that's wrong with our labor is that it's cursed. Not that labor is curse. I mean, it's not that work is the curse, but work is cursed. It's hard. He alludes to it in verses 22 and 23. He says, what has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. How many of you, you get home from work, or you know, whatever your work is, even going to bed at from any of your work, you know, whether it's raising your children or doing work outside of the home, but you go to bed and you can't go to bed. You can't sleep because all of your work is coming back to haunt you. The things that you didn't accomplish, you're wondering about. Did I finish that? I have to go back to that. The things that you did accomplish but accomplished poorly. I mean, how many of us as parents, just in the work of raising our children, we lie awake at night thinking through, just rehearsing all of the ways I did it wrong again today. I didn't do this. I didn't say this. I did say this. I did say that. I should have done this. I could have done this, and I didn't. And then all of our work, like even from our work, we go to bed and we can't rest. It doesn't let us rest. You know, you work for 25, 35, 45, 55 years, and what do you get from it? My dad has been working for the Sherwin-Williams Paint Company since 1965. And yes, I said present tense, has been working for the Sherwin-Williams Paint Company since 1965. For at least 20 years, he has been telling his family and co-workers, I will be retiring in 5 years. At least 20 years. So now that actually, that day is coming. It has been fixed. It is in February he will retire this coming year, February 2019. 53 and a half years with the Sherwin-Williams Paint Company. At 25 years, they send him a little catalog to pick something nice out for himself or for his wife or whatever. You know, you get those trinket bauble things. Nobody knows what these catalogs are anymore because nobody stays with a company for 25 years anymore. But if you do, you get a catalog and they'll tell you, hey, pick something out for yourself, something to celebrate 25 years. Do you know what my dad got? He got a painting, not really a painting, a print of people raking leaves into a fire. I don't know. That alone, when I realized that's where that painting came from, because I texted him this week, I said, when did you get things and what were they from Sherwin-Williams? So that was the first, the 25-year, the painting. He said, the painting of the people raking leaves. I was like, that's, they're raking leaves into a fire. I was like, that's like an Ecclesiastes illustration right there, just raking leaves into the fire, just all goes up in smoke. Anyway, he doesn't see it that way. He likes the painting. I'm glad he likes it. But that's what he got, a little painting, not very little, for 25 years of working for Sherwin-Williams. At 40 years, he got another catalog, and he picked out a bicycle. Okay, so they know that Grandpa's not the most exercise-friendly fellow on the planet, but it was a good effort. He was going to start exercising, get in better shape, and within 2 years, my mom gave the bicycle away. That bike isn't even at the house anymore. She gave it away. And now at 50 years, he got another catalog, and he picked out some power tools. He got some nice power tools, and so those power tools sit in his garage until my brother or I are there visiting, and then those power tools come out for whatever project they want my brother or me to work on when we're there. And it's nice because they're really nice power tools, but that's what he got for giving a half century of his life to the company, a box of power tools, a painting of raking leaves into a fire, a bicycle that his wife gave away less than 2 years later, and a box of power tools. And this is what you get from a company trying to say thank you for what you've done. This is a company trying to say, I appreciate it. That leaves aside when you work for a company for 25 or 35 years, and what you receive from them is grief and difficulty. And you realize that they are making your life harder and harder and harder with new little things that they put on you because they are tired of you working there. And so you go ahead and take that early retirement because you can tell they did not want you there anymore. You were slowing the process down. Or forget getting to 25 or 35 years. You take a step of faith. You have a good job. You have security. You're fine in your job. But here is this startup company. And oh, are they exciting. And oh, do they have everything that you would ever want. And you are the piece they need. You are going to put us on the map. What we need is for you to come in. And then suddenly they realize, but not so suddenly that you haven't walked away from your secure job, they realize that government work, government contracts are not the leprechaun pot of gold that we thought it was. And you were the last guy we hired, so you are the first guy we fire. And I know we said you were the key. It turns out you're not. Or you've built your reputation in a company. You have a good management team. You like the people you work with. And then a new management team comes in. And not only do they not know you, you're pretty sure they don't really like you. What was it all for? What is the point? What is the point of pouring yourself into a company that despises you, or pouring yourself into a team that will forget about you, or pouring yourself into a project that someone else is going to take credit for? In 1965, James Russell invented the CD. I mean, I know he didn't invent it in 65, but that's when he came up with the idea. He thought, you know what we need is we're going to use lasers. I mean, this sounds like something straight out of the movies. We're going to use lasers, and we're going to put the information onto these shiny circles, and then we'll use other lasers to read those shiny circles. And so he works on this, and in 1974, he even is acknowledged by Research and Development 100. He gets his award for his work. In 1980, he builds the first compact disc player. No one's really interested. A lot of people think, well, I don't know how far that's going to go. Everyone likes their records, their albums. And yet two companies are interested, or two groups, Sony and Philips, and so they license his work. But when they license his work, that means that they own the license for his work, so they get all of the money for the explosion of the compact disc era. And Russell got nothing. But we know who he is, right? Because he invented the compact disc, and that's a huge achievement until you realize that in 2018, Best Buy announces at the beginning of the year, we will not sell compact discs anymore. Music has gone so far that the compact disc is old and unnecessary, and stores don't carry them anymore. And so all of our collections of CDs now are sitting somewhere because we can't find them. And if we would find them, we would probably not have to spend $9 a month on Spotify. But we've got the CDs in the basement, and so we justify it, and it's okay. But here's even this. The whole technology, were the CDs even necessary? Did we need CDs to get to MP3? I don't know if we did. So here's an entire era, this man's entire invention. He pours his life into it. Not only does he not get money for it, but it turns out it was unnecessary. Music would have gone the exact place it went without him. And that's what he gets. And that's why none of you know who this dude Russell is. And this is just the normal wear and tear of work. This is just the normal side of work is hard. What about when you make mistakes? What about when it's you who did something wrong? Speaking of working for a long time in the same place, Joe Paterno was a football coach from 1950 to 2011. That's, yes, 62 years. Now, from 1950 to 1966, he was an assistant coach, all, by the way, at Penn State. And from 1966 to 2011, he was the head coach of the Penn State football team. He is the winningest head coach in NCAA Division I football, 409 victories. He has been to 37 bowls. He has won 24 of them. He has led his Penn State football team in 5 undefeated seasons. And he is barely known for any of that. He is known for what he didn't do. He is known because he did not go to the authorities when he learned that one of his assistant coaches was mistreating in horrific ways young boys in the Penn State locker room. And as that scandal unfolded in 2011, the information of the scandal was decades before that, but as the information came out in 2011, Joe Paterno announced, "This will be my last year coaching. I will resign at the end of this season." But that was not good enough for the Board of Trustees of Penn State, because somebody had to be blamed. Somebody currently in the system had to pay. And so they said, "We don't accept your resignation at the end of the season. We fire you effective immediately." You can't quit. You're fired. The statue at Beaver Stadium, I don't know why it's called Beaver Stadium, don't worry about it. The statue at Beaver Stadium on Penn State, in State College, of Joe Paterno, celebrating his successes, not just on the field, but the influence he had had on so many players, was taken down and has been put away in some locked, undisclosed storage place on the Penn State campus. The NCAA vacated all of the football team's wins from 1998 to 2011, which moved him from the winningest football coach in history to the 12th winningest football coach in history, which, by the way, was eventually overturned and those wins were reinstated. You can do so much good and so much right and have so much influence on people, and in one moment, not be remembered for any of it, but be remembered for the mistake you made when you were at work, for the thing you did wrong. And the preacher says, "I hated it. I hated life. I hated my work. I turned about and gave my heart to despair over all my work. It's all vexation. It's all sorrow. It's all meaningless. It's all empty and short." And as we are just bombarded with the pessimistic and negativity of the preacher in these first two chapters, as surprising as that is, because we just don't expect a book this raw, a book this honest about life in the Bible, if that surprises us, the last paragraph in chapter 2 surprises us in the opposite way, doesn't it? He says, "There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the busyness of gathering and collecting, only to give to the one who pleases God. This also is vanity, a striving after the wind." What is happening here? Now, modern commentaries, modern writers about Ecclesiastes will tell you there is nothing, there is no good news in Ecclesiastes till you get to chapter 12. So even this is him just cynically, skeptically saying, you know, so what is there to do? Just, I don't know, enjoy, eat, drink, enjoy that horrible job you have, because that's what you get from God. Is that what he's saying? Is that, it doesn't seem like that's the tone. And in fact, historically, commentaries on and preachers who have looked at these passages have historically said, no, this is a oasis of hope. This is a glimmer of hope. Martin Luther says of this paragraph, this is a remarkable passage, one that explains everything that precedes and follows it. I don't know if it's necessary to divide so starkly between those two understandings of this passage. Because can we be as honest as Ecclesiastes? Even as Christians, do you sometimes feel the meaninglessness and vaporousness of your work? Do you sometimes feel like there's nothing to show for what you've done? I mean, maybe you don't. Maybe you've found this place where no matter what is going on in your job, no matter what your boss is saying about you, no matter what the higher-ups think of you and your work, you are always in a place where, well, it's okay because I'm finding joy and contentment in what I do, and I'm not working for them, I'm working for Jesus. Maybe there is some sense in which, as Christians, we admit, you know what, sometimes it feels like all I can do is just some kind of Christian Dead Poet Society seize the day. I just need a carpe diem, apparently. You know, Dickens understood that it can be both good and bad, didn't he? I mean, his opening line in A Tale of Two Cities is, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. In fact, the story goes that his publisher didn't like that opening. His publisher said, Charles, you need to pick one. It can't be the best of times and the worst of times. I mean, you have to choose one. And his point was, no, sometimes it is both the best of times and the worst of times. Sometimes all you can do is look at your life and say, I don't know, I don't have an answer. And other times, no matter what is going on in your life, you've realized that, you know what, Christ is all. Christ is all. None of this matters. You know, when you take that fulcrum and you take that level with the negative on one side and the positive on the other side, and you put it up on like a capital T, or maybe make a cross, but go ahead and like put the above part of the cross above it and let those arms hold that bar level, because then you can realize that the point of the blank is, if I have Christ, I can be satisfied. If I have Christ, I can be satisfied. And now the negatives are balanced out. Now I'm not filled with shame. I'm not filled with emptiness. Yes, it hurts when I don't have these things, but it's not devastating because Christ has lifted me up out of this gloom. He's leveled it out. And at the same time, on the positive side, so let's say these things are all going great. My job is wonderful. But you know what? It's Christ that defines me. And so I'm not self-righteous. I'm not cocky or arrogant or proud because I know this isn't what defines me. Christ defines me. He lifts up those humiliating moments of lack and he drops down those arrogant moments of pride and stuff. And he says, no, I define you. Christ defines you. I am what you need. I fulfill you. You know, Paul had more reason than any of us to look at his own life as self-improvement and in his accomplishments and say, look at me, I had it all. And in Philippians 3, he starts describing himself, his self-improved life. He says, you know, I was an Israelite. I was from the tribe of Benjamin. I was circumcised on the eighth day. I was an Israelite of Israelites. In fact, I studied under great teachers. I was a Pharisee. I was righteous. I did everything right. And he summarizes it all and he says, but whatever gain I had, I counted as loss in Philippians 3:7. I counted as loss for the sake of Christ. Indeed, I count everything as loss because of the surpassing worth of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord. For his sake, I've suffered the loss of all things and I count them as rubbish in order that I may gain Christ and be found in him, not having a righteousness of my own that comes from the law, but that which comes from faith in Christ, the righteousness from God that depends on faith, so that I may know him and the power of his resurrection, so that by any means possible I may attain to the resurrection of the dead. It was none of this stuff, Paul says. What I had to get into my head was that it's Christ who had to satisfy me. It's Christ who died for my sins. It's Christ who entered this vaporous, meaningless existence. God comes down. He condescends and he enters and he takes on work. And he works with his hands and he's a carpenter and he works in Nazareth. But more than that, he works for our salvation. And all those little things we do to justify our existence, Christ says, I'll do this big thing and I will justify your existence. Listen, all the things that bring you joy and pleasure and contentment and satisfaction in life, even a job well done, all of these are gifts. They're supposed to be these little reflection pools that point you to the good giver. They weren't intended to be these little narcissistic reflection pools of yourself. You were supposed to back up and get a better angle and see Christ and see what God has done through these things. And we all recognize that in the gifts that we give to our children. You know, when you give your kids things, there's nothing more frustrating than when they don't look at the gift and bounce the look up to you and have some sense of gratitude. And how many of us in the gifts of pleasure or work or self-improvement do we look at these things and say, well, I got this because I'm all that and a bag of chips? And how frustrating is it? All he wants is like, I gave you that so that you would see how loving I am. I gave you that so you'd see how generous I am. I gave you that so that you could use it to help others and serve others. Your self-improvement wasn't just for you to improve, but so that you could improve others as well. So that you might realize that your satisfaction comes from your relationship with me, not your relationship with your job or with your stuff. If I have Christ, I can be satisfied. Let's pray. Jesus, I pray that we would, even as our assurance of pardon and grace reminded us, that we would consider you, who for the joy set before you endured the cross. You are the author and perfecter of our faith. You are the giver of all good gifts. Whether pleasure or wisdom or satisfying jobs, these gifts come from you. When we have them, may we not be so arrogant and proud, but let us be grateful. And when they are lacking, I pray that we would not be filled with the lie of shame, but that we would know what I need is Christ, and what I have is Christ. It's in your name we pray. Amen.